Hi, everybody. This is Joel Whitaker, editor of Kane's Beverage News Daily. I'm talking this afternoon with Bill Samuels, who just recently announced that he was going to retire from the president and CEO position at Maker's Mark Distillery. And we're sort of curious as to how he got, as to his story about how he got into the business, how the business has changed over time, what he thinks are the keys to success for his company, and perhaps looking forward to the future, what are the keys to success for the rest of the industry. So, Bill Samuels, Jr., how are you this afternoon?
Well, I'm fine. Good afternoon to you, my friend.
Thank you, sir. So tell us a little bit about how you got started. I know your dad bought the distillery. Were you around when they signed the papers, or was that slightly before your time?
The saga, which has affectionately become known as Maker's Mark, really started in our living room one day when Mom screwed up her courage and announced to my father that he needed to get a job. And this was back 1951. And he lollygagged around and hung around and thought what he wanted to do in his retirement was to run our farm. Well, Mom had been running the farm successfully, didn't think she needed his help, and announced that not only did he need to get a job, he needed to get out of the house, and he was welcome back at 6 o'clock in the evening, but not before. So that's really what kicked him over the edge. He had had this idea, had been talking. I don't remember much of it because I was a small lad at the time, but I do remember some conversations where he always talked about trying to create a bourbon that didn't have any bitterness, that was more in the refined area. I'm not sure he knew how to do it. Matter of fact, I don't believe he did at that time, even though he was a trained engineer, as was his father. And of course, they ran the T.W. Samuels Distillery right after Prohibition for a number of years. So in, I believe it was sometime in the fall of 1953, after 2 years of weaving and dodging around Mom's demands, he finally acquiesced, and he and I went to Marion County Courthouse, and he purchased what was then the Burke's Springs Distillery, and said at the time, the only thing I really remember about this, he said this is the biggest check he'd ever written, and it was $35,000, and that got us started. The next thing he did, which provided some enlightenment to the obstacles that lay ahead, he went to his best friend and asked him to serve on the board, and he said yes. And then he went to him as a board member. This guy was also the senior vice president of the bank, and he said he'd like to borrow some money. And the banker said, no, there's no future for bourbon. It's been going down. Each of the last 5 years, the American public has decided that they prefer the nicer, more sophisticated, imported adult beverages, and there he was left without any money. That at that moment, this dream of his went from being a business to a hobby, and it stayed a hobby for about 14 years. And I think because it did, it allowed him to gear back expectations, to focus on the craft, to not get in too big a hurry, and to not get over-leveraged financially. The next thing he did, because his best friends were the other distillers, and that was, to me, that was marvelous, because on Saturday, I got to go with him. We drove down to Lynchburg to visit the Motlows a number of times. We walked next door to visit the Beams. They were our next-door neighbor. In fact, Colonel Jim Beam was my godfather up until he died in 1947. And Mr. Ed Shapiro, who was the founder of the Heaven Hill Distillery, was one of the ones that Ed consulted, as was Pappy Van Winkle. All great men, and they helped enormously in guiding Dad at what he had to do differently in order to create the type of bourbon that he had on his mind. Mom was a chemist and really smart, and she got involved as they were playing with different grains, and she had an idea that maybe the best way to find out which grains which flavor grains best complemented corn on the soft side of the scale. They had already decided that rye, which was our traditional formula and is the traditional formula for bourbon, had to go. And so they were playing with a variety of other things, and Mom decided, well, why don't we bake bread with these other grains and see which ones are the softest? And from that little experiment of making maybe 150 loaves of bread, she and my father decided red winter wheat should be the flavor grain for this new whiskey. Again, no idea what would happen after they started. And then in February of 1954, my sisters and I missed, at least for me, it was the only day of school I missed all the way through middle school and high school. And it was for the first barrel entry from the distillery. It was the first barrel that was produced of new whiskey. And Dad had all the competitive distillers down who were his best friends that I'd mentioned before, and there, it was cold. It was in February, and we had a little ceremony back in the barrel room where Dad was going to burn the old family formula, which would have been his three great-grandfathers. We've owned, managed bourbon distilleries in Kentucky, the Samuels, since 1784, with the interruptions of Prohibition, World War II, and that period after the war, Dad was out of business, and so he wanted to do his Cortez thing. We were leaving tradition behind, and we were going to reinvent a bourbon that actually tasted good. Those were his exact words, and part of that meant this breaking with tradition to take the old family formula and burn it. And for the little ceremony, he had a jug yeast bucket, which has a very narrow opening at the top. He put the formula in some other papers, spread some lighter fluid around, and just as he dropped a match into this bucket, my sister put her head over the bucket, and because of the nature of the bucket with a big base and a very small opening, he had, in fact, dropped the match into a rocket nozzle. And so it wasn't a burn, it was an explosion. And the fire came up and singed my sister's hair. So that was the main attraction of the day.
Oh, my goodness.
It was also the last time we ever tried to do a ceremony. But that got us off to a start. And then I didn't pay any more attention to it, to be honest with you. I went off to college to become a rocket scientist. We had just experienced Sputnik my senior year in high school, and a couple of us that were pretty good in math decided that we wanted to go off to California and help with the space race. And so I did that for a number of years, and without getting into a lot of stories here, I had a very bad thing happened. One of my projects failed and I got terminated, so I figured that would be a good time to come back in the business. I called Dad and he wouldn't give me a job, so I went on down to Vanderbilt Law School. Did that for 3 years and learned the business from none other than Hap Motlow, who was Jack Daniel's great nephew. His father was Lem Motlow, whose name is still on the bottle of Jack Daniel's.
Mm-hmm.
And Jack Daniel's corporate office was right across the street from the back door of the law school. And Hap and I, we would do something every Friday. He and my father were just great friends. And I'd go to the distillery. I'd go play gin rummy with he and his old buddies. Friday afternoon, we'd go out in his boat and drink too much whiskey and trying to bring his yacht back into the dock sideways. So we had some good times, not all of them constructed. But at the end of that 3 years, I really got excited about the industry, and it was mainly because all the time I'd spent with the Jack Daniel's family. And so I went back to Dad and asked him if he'd have me again, and he said, yeah. he'd give it a try, and I told him I'd come back if he could see his way to think about this as a business rather than a hobby, to see if we really couldn't try to do something. And, of course, I had no idea what to do. Dad's interest was in creating great whiskey, not so much in the marketing side. So he left the outside to me. My job was go find customers. And I took off and didn't get much done, fiddled with it for about 8 or 9 years, about ready to give up, go practice law, when we decided that the problem was I didn't know how to do my job. And that's when we hired an advertising agency, not to do ads, but to teach me. And through that effort, and some luck, because in 1980, the major break that I think probably had more to do, if you were to pin one date on when significant interest in premium bourbon occurred, it was August 1, 1980, and that's when the Wall Street Journal did a front page center column feature on my father and his little hobby, and that blew the roof off of the interest in Makers. Of course, we didn't have any distribution out of Kentucky at that time. We were only selling a few thousand cases, and we wound up the distillery, and we knew it'd be 6 years, so we begged and borrowed bottles of whiskey from Kentucky and sent them out to fine restaurants in San Francisco and Washington, New York, Boston. Not too much, but just enough to keep the interest level from disappearing after that article. And it actually worked. I mean, we were all kind of amazed that by the time that the expansion in the distillery was up with mature whiskey, the demand was there. It had even increased, and we've been on a nice roll ever since. Ever since that Wall Street Journal article, we've had double-digit growth every year for our brand. And I think if my father, who died in 1992, were to come back, he would say that as he looked around and saw how tremendously respected bourbon is, not only in the United States and among the young professionals everywhere, but what's going on internationally, and what a firestorm bourbon has created in Europe, in Asia, and it just looks like it's right in the beginning. It was one of those things that just looked impossible back in 1953, and here we are today. We've got a very much an iconic brand, and the good news, I think, for all of us in the industry is that every distillery is sharing in that success, and each one of them has at least one premium brand of bourbon that is doing really, really well. And believe it or not, my job was not to screw it up. And if you were asking me about what, as I look back, what should I have done better, different? I would have said, how come it took so long to get started? It really took me a long time to understand how to take what was in my father's heart and translate it into commercial activities.
Mm-hmm.
And if it hadn't have been for the work of our advertising agency working with me while teaching me my job, while extracting from my father the very essence of his vision and his dream, probably there wouldn't be a Maker's Mark today, and possibly there wouldn't be a premium bourbon category. So, you know, as I look back, that's the thing that embarrasses me the most, that it took so long to start listening to the man that created the product and realize he also had a dream for the brand and a dream for bourbon. And that was to move bourbon from kicking cowboys and Wild West and commodity to the top shelf in the fine watering holes around the world. And then we just went about the task of getting it done.
Now, at some point along the line, you all decided to put that little red wax seal on top of your bottle.
Oh, that was at the beginning. That was at the beginning.
Uh-huh.
As you may have gathered from the early story about mom controlling who was in the household when.
I like that story. My wife will like it even better, by the way.
Well, it happened. Mom decided that Dad's commercial instincts were just not adequate, and he was when he would come home for dinner after the second and third and fourth year, he kept talking about how the whiskey was maturing and how wonderfully it was developing, and then year five and year six, oh, this was just great, but she never heard him talk about what's he going to call it, how's he going to sell it, who's going to want to buy it, how much is he going to charge, blah, blah, blah. So she kind of took over and figured the first thing she needed to do, since we didn't have any money to hire a design firm, was to name the package and design it. And so she went about that business, took her all 3 or 4 months, and she had never designed a package before, never designed one since. And it's clearly her contribution has really added almost as much as my father's. He created what's on the inside. She created what's wrapped around it. And that iconic red wax, that came from the fact that we had about 18 old, mid-19th century, from the 1800s, cognac bottles that were sealed to keep the air out. Old cognac bottles, and she thought that was a nice touch. And if she could only make that functional cue a visual cue, and being a chemist, she understood that she needed to back off some of the viscosity, and she needed to add some pigment so that it actually had color rather than that dullness that existed in all the old sealing waxes from 150 years ago. And so she played with that in our basement and came up with it, and what we've got now, which is what, 50 some odd years ago, it's the same thing. I've got the first bottle at home, and it looks like what we're using today.
Amazing. So her chemical training came into good use for y'all.
It was probably more of her bossy nature than it was the other. Maybe been both.
Well, that could be too, couldn't it? So Bill, what was your role aside from learning from the ad agency? What were you doing when you came aboard and as this brand took off after? How did the Wall Street Journal find out about it, first of all?
Well, it was an accident, as so many things are, and you just, if you've got your ears up, you listen, you take advantage of it. There was a journalist, an editor for the Wall Street Journal, that was responsible for adult beverages. He lived in St. Louis, I think. He was in for the Humana Corporation, which at that time was a hospital company, large hospital company,
mm-hmm.
For their annual meeting. And it just happened to be the night that, or the day that we had our national landmark ceremony at the distillery, where we had invited the Secretary of the Interior. This is when Makers became the first bourbon distillery to become a national historic landmark. I think it was the first beverage facility in the entire United States to become a national landmark, and they had some federal dignitaries in, and the press was down, and when this guy went back to the bar at the Brown Hotel, they happened to have the news on, and that was on the news, and he said, "Hey, I never heard of this place. This sounds interesting." The bartender knew who I was, and they were able to get my phone number. I was at home. He called. He said his airplane wasn't leaving the next day till the afternoon, and if I had any time, he would love to see the distillery. And then I said, "Great, let's go. I'll pick you up 7 o'clock." And then I had to call my father and tell him, and Dad didn't like the press. He didn't like marketers. And I had to tell my father I had a fraternity brother in town that wanted to see the distillery and really wanted to meet him. And so I tricked him into it. I knew him being a gentleman, he would put up with it, and then he'd beat hell out of me after the guy was gone. But he only did, that was one of only three interviews he ever did. He only made one speech, and I tricked him into that too.
Amazing. Well, that certainly sounds like it was the breakthrough moment for the brand, if you will, and you know, purely by accident, you just got lucky.
I don't want to read too much into this, but as an observer of history, and I really have been sort of hanging around bourbon people for all of my 70 years, I think it might have been the breakthrough moment for bourbon.
Mm-hmm.
Because when Dad bought that little distillery, they were shutting down about one every 2 weeks, 2 to 3 weeks.
And you know, I remember the late 70s because the Mad Mothers had come on the scene.
Yes.
And the whole world was talking about how the alcohol beverage business was going to collapse and be out of business in 6 months. I mean, your friends up the road there at Brown-Forman went off and bought themselves a lamp company and some other stuff. And I also remember that story on the front page of the Journal. We used to call it the A-head when I worked at the Journal. And, you know, I do remember it. And, you know, even today, it was a quirky little story. It fit the formula just perfectly. And, you know, and it's very interesting. And I think you may be right. That may have been the thing that that turned the corner for the bourbon side. And around that time also, we had the French Paradox.
It started to give people confidence. But
yeah.
Because we didn't have distributors. We didn't have anybody that cared about makers outside of Kentucky and maybe 10 or 15 miles up the interstate highway.
Right.
And when that thing hit, distributors from all over the country were making airplane reservations to come to Kentucky. And after, you know, it took a while, but after, what, that was 1980, by about 1988 is when I think Jim Beam had the Small Batch Collection, Ancient Age launched Blanton's in the United States, great whiskeys, all,
mm-hmm.
and they were successful, and it started to give the industry a little gravitas, I think, where I'm not sure how far we could have taken it by ourselves. The fact that the other companies jumped in, turned their master distillers loose, and some great creativity came forward, and it still is.
Terrific. And now, what once the Journal story appeared, that must have changed the way you marketed the product. Not immediately, but certainly within a year or so.
And we had one of the most fabulous discussions the minute the Wall Street Journal that particular issue arrived at the office. Dad said, "That's great." And I said, "Yes, but it's not over. It's just beginning." And that was like at 8 o'clock in the morning. By 8:15, we had ordered 5 new phone lines. We had taken my sisters, who were younger than me at the time and had gone into full retirement early, and put them on the phones. Dad and I committed every night and every weekend to personally respond to the letters we got. And we had over 25,000 letters as a result of that Wall Street Journal article. And we didn't keep count of the phone calls, but it was way up in the thousands. And that's when we said, "Hey, we finally got somebody interested in what we do. Now we feel comfortable that we can talk back to them." So we took out our first ad. It was in the Journal, and it was thanking folks for their interest in what we do in Loretta. "We recognize you're going to have a horrible time finding it because it doesn't exist much outside Kentucky. Just be patient and keep in touch and tell us where you'd like for us to have some." And, you know, we kept the conversation going for 6 years until the whiskey finally started showing up.
Amazing. That must have been a real challenge to keep that conversation going. But it was effective marketing.
It was really the first time on a commercial/marketing issue that my father and I were totally aligned. Because
mm-hmm.
I figured what you did, you went and bought sewing kits and you put your logo on them and started throwing them around the bus station. I didn't know. And he never liked that approach. He always figured that you talked to the people that were interested, and you kept engaged with them, and they would in fact go influence and talk to their friends if they thought the product was worthy of recommendation, and it would be the classic discovery model.
Sure.
And here we were executing exactly what he wanted to happen. And it was, I mean, it was phenomenal. It's the best, it was the most fun 5 years that I've had in the business. The next fun thing was creating 46, which went on the market 6 months ago, and what a phenomenal success that's been.
Tell us a little bit about that process.
Well, here's what we did. When we started, we said this is not going to be a gimmick. This is not going to be something to go sell. We're not going to play with proof and age and all this silly stuff. It actually has to taste good. So I got with our master distiller, Kevin Smith, and said, Kevin, what's the template? Let's see if we can mirror what Mom and Dad did when they started. So we actually defined what winning would look like, and it was all organoleptic. There was a flavor profile that we were trying to get to. We later learned it was impossible, but we didn't know that at the time. And that was a really rich, full body, long, long finish, and no bitter aftertaste. Meaning that we tried to create a really full-bodied whiskey that all the flavor was in the front half of the tongue. Okay? The bourbons, because of the nature of the extractions, the longer it stays in the barrel, the more tannic acid it pulls out. So yes, you get a lot of flavor, but an awful lot of it's the back of the mouth where the concentration of bitter taste buds are.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what we didn't want. And as we went down this road, we realized how hard it would be. Some PhDs working with us said, you can't do it. And we kept at it. We did 123 experiments, and then we finally realized we didn't know what we were doing. So we brought in the guy that makes our barrels and does all of the flavor staves for the wine industry around the world. And he had a couple of PhDs in biology and chemistry. And he got interested in the project. He also said it was impossible. And got working on it and stumbled into the solution one night when he was barbecuing steaks at home. He was thinking about our project. How in the world can he lock that tannic acid in and still release a lot of the sweet oak flavors, the caramels, the vanillins?
Mm-hmm.
And he said, well, why don't I cook my flavor staves that I'll be inserting in those Maker's Mark barrels the same way that I'm cooking my steaks right now, Pittsburgh style? Why don't I sear the surface to lock in flavor? Now, with the staves, it was for the opposite effect. With steaks, you're trying to lock in good flavor. We were trying to lock the acids inside so that when the whiskey hit the surface and extracted those sweet oak flavors right at the surface, they would have a hard time penetrating down to the tannic acids.
Mm-hmm.
And so we would get more sweet oak, none of the tannins. And so he went in his office, or his lab, the next morning, Sunday morning, and cranked up the oven and proceeded to blow the oven up. Then he got the oven fixed, and he said, I've got something. I don't know if it's going to work, but conceptually we all agree it might work. And so he brought a couple of guys down to the distillery, and we inserted these 10 seared, air-dried French oak staves in a barrel of Maker's Mark. It was already 6 years old. And we waited, and we tested it every day for 3 months, and it didn't start out too good, and then it finally rounded out just perfectly. I've never been so excited about anything in my life. And so that's the story of 46.
Terrific. Now, At some point along the line, you sold the distillery to Fortune Brands?
No, sold it to, remember, I said hobby back in the old days.
Yep.
While it was incorporated, there was never any attempts at family planning, estate planning.
Mm-hmm.
Mom owned half the business, Dad owned half the business. It was a hobby, didn't mount anything. And after that Wall Street Journal, the value took off.
Right.
And so it became a major part of their estate. Simultaneous with that, my mom got deathly ill, and
mm-hmm.
we were going to have a horrible estate problem. If you remember, it was in the early days of Ronald Reagan before he was able to secure the great reduction in estate taxes.
Sure.
At that time, they were 90%. And so Dad was going to have to give up the thing anyway. So he and I went out and found a family company that we knew the people. It was Hiram Walker, and it was the Hatch family. And they purchased the distillery, and I stayed on. And the Hatch family managed to protect me until we had enough credibility that we could kind of stand on our own feet. When Hiram Walker sold to Allied, which was in 6 or 7 years, Allied Lions, and then it was Allied Domecq, and Allied Domecq went out of business, and they sold some of the brands to Fortune Brands,
mm-hmm.
and that was 5 years ago. And we have had very good parents, and they have appreciated and respected somewhat the heritage that we bring to the table, but I think a whole lot more the art and the craft, and you have to treat it differently than just a hard-nosed commercial venture.
Right.
Now, that's not to say that the performance has been bad, because we have had double-digit growth every year as an industry that's been growing about 1.5%. So we've way outperformed the other brands, but the senior management in these companies that I've worked with, they've been very encouraging. They've been great guardians with us and for us, and that's been 29 years ago. And I would challenge you or anybody else to find a parent company that has nurtured a little jewel as well as we've been allowed to nurture.
Sure. Well, that's very interesting. I had forgotten, but you're absolutely right. Estate taxes back when Reagan took office were 90%, and
yeah.
You know, the death of family businesses year after year.
They had no chance back then.
Yeah. So, I guess I'm glad that the estate tax has come down significantly, and hope it stays down significantly.
I hope it stays at 35. That seems like a fair rate to me. I don't want to get into politics, but. And then the next example of guardianship is right now. Here it is, 2010. Jim Beam's going through an awful lot of trials and tribulations with the breakup of different pieces of Fortune Brands. And here they are coming to me and telling me I did not push this. And they say, we think the best person for your successor is your son. That's pretty cool.
That is pretty cool.
And it really is amazing the amount of sensitivity, the amount of appreciation and respect they have for what we've been able to stumble into over all these years. And it really goes to the product. It goes to our customers that demand a great product. And as we've grown, I've said our number one objective is not to increase the growth, but to make sure we don't screw up while we're growing, because that's
mm-hmm.
when it's the easiest to screw it up.
Mm-hmm. Sure is. So what with your son scheduled to take over in April, I think, isn't it?
Yeah, if he doesn't throw me out before then.
I doubt that he'll do that, but one never knows, I guess. What sort of advice are you giving him about how to... how to maintain what you and your dad have done here?
No, I don't give him. This is going to be a great transition, and I don't want to sound like a social scientist, but Robin, unlike most fathers and sons that get into these situations, He and I have almost identical personalities. So we can talk to each other without actually talking.
Yeah.
It is amazing. Now, Dad and I had to work at it because he was more the craftsman and I was more the out-of-control crazy. But Rob and I are both out of control.
Mm-hmm.
I think his common sense might be a little greater and I might be a little more on the creative side. But it's great. Plus, he had the good fortune of not working with his grandfather, but knowing his grandfather really, really well and spending
right.
a lot of time with him. And working at the distillery when he was in school, and he's been with me now back here 5 years, and he did what I asked him to do after he got out of college, which was go be successful doing something else, and then we'll talk.
Mm-hmm.
And he did it, and so I've been, you know, there's nothing I can tell him. I'll be available. I'll be hanging around, and he may choose to take me to lunch, but not ask me any questions.
That works.
That'd be fine.
That would be fine.
No, I don't think. I've told a lot of people, and they know it, especially the ones that work with us, like our agencies and all. The leadership in April will improve.
Well, considering the fact that you've done an awfully good job of stewardship, that's good news for the future of the distillery there.
Well, my message, and the only, you know, some of our fans are a little concerned that I'm going away. One, I'm not going away. And two, Rob really is better. So I think we're good for at least another 25 years or so.
Good. Excellent. So it'll be good to watch the evolution of Maker's Mark over the next 25 years and see how that brand and how 46 comes along. And I'm sure it'll be a great story. And in 25 years, my successor, whomever that may be able to do another phone call, except with your son. So that would be absolutely
might be
terrific.
My grandson then.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So, Bill, are there any things that we should have talked about that we didn't? I sort of let you tell your story, which is exactly what I wanted to do here.
I don't know.
Bill, maybe you just want to talk about the new role as chairman emeritus.
Well, I don't know. Rob's trying to give me a job description. I've not had one in 43 years. so this will be an interesting exercise. I think what he wants me to do is continue to do what I love doing, which is hanging out with customers, both trade customers and consumer customers, brand fans. And we've got a lot of them, and we know who a lot of them are, and we know how to get in touch with them, and I like to travel. So there's a good chance that a good bit of it will be there. We are going through right this moment a significant investment at the distillery, and I've been through a couple of them, and I am an engineer, so I could help him with that. I think the marketing side, I think he's pretty much ready to run down his own road there, and I think it'll be a good solid road.
Terrific. Well, that sounds like a great transition. And Bill, I want to thank you for your time here. We're going to put this, I think, on our website. I think it came out just fine. I'll write a story or two about it, and I'll make sure that you get copies of those. And you know, I really wish you well. You've done a terrific job over the years, and I'm sure your son will do equally well.
I'm counting on it.
So, Bill Samuels, Jr., thank you so very much for your time today, and we'll look forward to seeing what transpires next.
All right, Joel, thank you.
Uh-huh. Bye-bye.